KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Brain.
Transactions could rapidly transform this industry to one that is effectively under the control of a foreign government. And that is obviously not something that would be desirable.
A lot of the events of The Hobbit are actually setting up and establishing forces at work which are later going to be big players in The Lord of the Rings.
Even though we have not made a profit, it's perhaps time for us to make a contribution to the UK society.
That was Liberal Canadian MP Mark Garneau talking about the China-Nexen deal. Good morning. This is 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Coming up in just a couple minutes, we're going to be talking with Canadian correspondent Vaughn Palmer about various takeovers of Canadian energy companies by Asian interests. But first, just talking about what we're going to be doing this hour, Peter Jackson was discussing The Hobbit, and it's not one movie, it's three movies, because why do one when you can do three? Robert Horton talks about that. And protesters in the United Kingdom don't like Starbucks. Starbucks not paying taxes there. Michael Parks joins us to talk about Northwest Icon Industries. That's all coming up this hour on Weekday. But first to Canada, where Canadians proud of their homegrown businesses, but Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government has okayed the Asian takeovers of two Canadian energy companies in the last week or so. Why? The man with the answer to that question and more is Vancouver Sun political columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, Marcy.
So one of these takeovers was, do you call them takeovers? Are they really takeovers? The Nexen company. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you've got a lot of interest being shown in Canadian energy companies that control significant energy resources, particularly oil, but also natural gas. Asian companies looking to take them over. Canada has had a policy, kind of an ad hoc policy on foreign takeovers, where our government says we'll approve them, providing we see a net benefit to Canadians. But the guidelines kind of go back to the old days when most of the buyers were private corporations in other countries. And we haven't really had a set of rules to deal with the emerging trend, which is state-owned enterprises, the Chinese National Oil Company, Petronas, the big government-owned oil company in Malaysia. What do we do with them? The old corporate test doesn't seem to apply. There's concerns that these state-owned enterprises are actually more like foreign governments taking over a piece of your economy than foreign companies. So our government kind of They held off approving two big takeovers this year, Marcy, and then on Friday, fairly dramatically, our Prime Minister called a press conference and announced that both of the takeovers were being approved, but the government was also bringing in new rules to deal with future state-owned enterprise takeovers. So the approval is for two big Canadian energy companies, one to be taken over by the Chinese National Oil Company, and this is a company that the Americans rejected taking over Unocal a while ago, and the other by Petronas, which is a Malaysian-owned company. So those two get in, they get what they were looking to buy, they get to take over Canadian companies, but the Prime Minister also said in future the rules are going to be clarified and toughened so that we don't end up with our entire energy sector owned essentially by foreign governments.
Vaughn, we're talking about $20 billion in takeover money. Who gets that money? Does it go to the private company?
Yeah, the shareholders in the companies.
Wow.
Right? And you know, the feeling here was that because the government had never really faced this question, it would have been unfair to investors, unfair to owners in Canada to change the rules right at the end of the game. The feeling was that the government had to let these two go ahead because they'd allowed them to proceed to the final stage. that because we didn't have clear rules, and particularly clear rules on state-owned enterprises, they really couldn't turn them down, and they didn't. The other side of that, though, is some concern as to what the new rules mean, whether the new rules mean hands-off or just simply a much steeper test that, for example, if the Chinese National Oil Company wished to buy another piece of the action in Canada, whether they would face a much stiffer test next time. It looks as if they would.
What was the reaction of the public?
I think there's some genuine apprehension in Canada, particularly about Chinese companies. They're seen, I would say they're seen in kind of suspicious terms as I say, as sort of agents of a foreign government that may not have all the same interest, our best interests at heart. It's also very hard to do comparisons because the Chinese economic system is so different mm-hmm. from ours. If it were the Norwegian oil company, I don't think it would be as much of a problem. Approving the Malaysian oil company was not as difficult an approval. At the same time, who's got all the money in the world at the moment? Canadians are, I think, gratified to know that people are willing to invest here. We probably couldn't manage. Canada's always needed investment from outside. It's always taken investment from outside. The UK years ago and the United States for a long time. So it's not unheard of for us to go outside for investment dollars. It's just in this case we're taking a, you know, I think Americans have the same mixed feelings about China mm-hmm. that we do, is what exactly are we dealing with here? It's a new kind of entity, a new kind of economic arrangement that we're just not that familiar with, and so there's some genuine apprehension.
Well, another big decision that the Harper government made was to cancel the purchase of an F-35 jet fighter.
Yeah, I'm jumping ahead of the news cycle a little bit there. The word has been out for about a week that Canada's walking away from this thing. We've got a press conference called in our national capital this afternoon by our defense minister, and the buzz is that he's going to kill the F-35 purchase outright. There's been some speculation that what the government was going to do was simply back away from the plans to purchase those American jet fighters, put the whole thing out for tender again, or otherwise revisit the deal. But this is all driven by the stories that have been in all over the United States media as well, which is the escalating price tag for the F-35. It's one of the most expensive military procurement programs in history, I think, and it's we're one of the prime customers, and our government is just looking at this price tag and going, we can't really afford these things.
The purchase was also subject of a kind of controversial audit earlier this year, right?
Yeah, our government gave some really bogus figures on this up front. It's crazy with military procurement to lowball the numbers up front because you know they're going to escalate. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think some of the U.S. Congressional Budget Office has led the ringing of alarm bells on this, and the Budget Office in our Parliament in Ottawa has done the same. It's just said the government numbers don't stand up. You've got to look at all-in prices on these procurements. You don't just look at the cost of the jets up front, but what it's going to cost to maintain them and service them, which is huge. And as I said, I think the betting line this morning is that the government is just going to kill the thing outright. The other possibility, the fallback possibility, I suppose, is that they would, you know, just kind of revisit it in some way. But I think you're going to see they're just kind of just going to walk away from these things because for the same reason, I think there's an awful lot of people in the United States wondering what you're into in terms of a price tag on these things as well.
Well, just the last question on that subject, the current jet fighters, CF-18s that the RCAF flies, are kind of at the end of their operable lifespan. So are folks in charge rethinking? I mean, you're going to have to spend some money, or maybe you're just not going to have jet fighters anymore.
Well, you know, the CF-18s are like you know, not quite the sup with camel, but they really are out of date, and they're very dangerous. You know, that they're dangerous for the people that fly them, right? And if you're going to have a military and fighter jets, you need something modern. Whether you need something as expensive and overbuilt as the F-35, I think, is a question. The Canadian government is now going, you know, if we were to just put this out to tender again, I wonder what some other countries might come forward with in terms of a better deal. Do we really need to jump to the next century? Wouldn't we be better off with something that would be a little more modest that you might see in the air forces of some of the other NATO allies?
Well, we're going to go from jet air fighting capabilities to, I'm not sure if seaworthiness is the right description, but if you have ever traveled from Victoria to Port Angeles, as I have, you have taken a Blackball ferry, most likely, and the Blackball ferry line just inked a deal with the state of Washington that at least is going to make things look really great in Port Angeles.
Yeah, this is an important link between British Columbia and Washington State. It's especially important for Vancouver Island, where I live and work, and the Olympic Peninsula. Tourism in both directions. It's a venerable institution here too. The Coho has been serving those waters for 50 years. They went through a very interesting transformation last year, where the employees themselves bought the ship and now operate it. There was some concern here a couple of years ago, which I covered on the show, Marcy, over the city of Victoria talking about ejecting the Coho from the harbor, which was stupid because it comes right into the harbor and it delivers lots of walk-on passengers here every day. I'm just encouraged to see that employee ownership is going so well that they are now incorporating a rebuild of the terminal into a redevelopment of the Port Angeles waterfront. I just think it's great news for Port Angeles, but it's great news for the whole region, too, in terms of an important link for tourism and commerce.
It's a 30-year lease with 3 10-year extension options,
yeah.
So that's it. We're there forever.
Yeah, and I love Port Angeles anyway. It's a lovely little town, and you know, they've had some rough times over the years there on the peninsula. You can't make all your living from vampire tourism, so as I said, for them too, I see they're talking about a $17 million waterfront revitalization, and that will include rebuilding the Coho terminal. I hope they make a little more space in the terminal so that you can get on and off the boat more quickly. It might make it a little easier for that crew that now owns the ship to keep the ship on time as well.
So the Coho did not get booted from the Victoria Harbor, but are they planning a similar investment in the Victoria area?
We've got some work going on in Victoria Harbor, so that's possible. Victoria, as you will know from following our sewage treatment story for the last 3 centuries, loves to study things and not actually do anything. So I think the new development on the Port Angeles waterfront will be up and running and probably needing another paint job before we get anything done up here.
And I'm not sure how briefly we'll be, how deeply we'll be able to treat this in the brief amount of time we have left. But we're nearly a week into a global conference talking about the future of international telecommunications, and the big question with the United States as sort of the barrier is whether the internet should be regulated.
Yeah, I haven't seen an awful lot of coverage on this, although here and there there's been some stories. The conference, basically Canada and the United States are on the same page on this one, working together to try to get the idea is an international telecommunications treaty, and Canada and the United States are arguing against some other countries, Russia, the African and Middle East nations, that this treaty should not try to deal with the internet, that the internet shouldn't be part of the principles of telecommunications regulation, that in itself would prevent the rise and expansion of the internet. My favorite detail in the story that I'm looking at here, which I think is a New York Times piece, is that the website for the conference was hacked and crashed on the first day. So I think the blogosphere has already offered its comment on whether or not the internet should be regulated.
Well, Vaughn, it's great as always to talk to you, and you'll be back next week, I hope.
We will stay in touch. Thanks, Marcy.
Thanks. Vaughn Palmer is a political writer for the Vancouver Sun, a regular Wednesday guest on our show on 94.9 KUOW.
Are you spending your precious time and money to get your loved ones exactly the right gift this season? Why?
Truth is, you're not that interesting. The person who's about to get the present's going to get dozens of others, and they'll probably forget about what you're going to give them.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. A Freakonomics look at holiday giving. That's next time on Marketplace. We'll have the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street as well. It's from APM.
And that comes your way tonight at 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. It's 10:20. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle First Baptist Church, a welcoming faith community on Seattle's Capitol Hill, offering Sing Love, a holiday concert at 7:30 p.m. on December 15th and 1 p.m. on December 16th. More information available at seattlefirstbaptist.org.
Clouds and rain, 44 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting rain this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, the high in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight with some fog overnight, the low in the upper 30s.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy.
I was too busy talking about chocolate-covered popcorn to just jump on my cue there. This is Thursday, and Robert Horton's here. Some of us spend every Christmas, I'm raising my hand, revisiting Peter Jackson's epic Lord of the Rings trilogy all in one day, Christmas Day.
Okay.
Some of us, not me, I put my hand down, have been pining for another epic about hobbits and dwarves and elves. I'm not pining. I don't not welcome it. Uh-huh. But Peter Jackson has complied with our wishes, and part one of the Hobbit trilogy opens, I think, tomorrow night at midnight, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that's correct.
And you've seen the film, you've been to Middle Earth and returned to talk about it.
There and back again.
There and back again. I've got to say, can we talk about the source material?
Oh, of course.
Just
yeah,
a moment.
Sure.
The Lord of the Rings was three books. It kind of made sense to have three movies. The Hobbit is not the same kind of book. It's a book, for one thing, but it's not even aimed at the same audience.
I think you are making a couple of excellent distinctions here. Yes, that is that's true. It's one of the things that, you know, when it was announced that not... At first they said The Hobbit, well, we're going to do it as two movies. And then Peter Jackson started getting into it and came out with this, we're going to make three films out of The Hobbit. And I assume that was good news for the studio because they all look for ways of extending the lives of these franchises. But yeah, it's not a long book. It's a normal sized book with this kind of a simple, charming story.
It was written for children.
Yes, 1937. Talking about J.R.R. Tolkien.
Oh, I'm sorry, the author.
Who doesn't already know that. But yeah, and you know, Jackson, in watching this movie, actually, it's occasionally surprising because you're in the Lord of the Rings world, and you have those kinds of associations, but then there'll be like jokes and gags and things that are really kind of aimed at much younger audiences. And you think, oh, okay, so we're kind of aiming there now. It took me, I'm not sure I am reconciled to that, actually, having watched the first movie. But
it's not about dark, dark, evil places. There are some dark, dark, evil places.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's got the outline of a classic fable. It's got all the archetypes that are in those kinds of things. But it's a little more kid-oriented. And yet, you know, then there's also these dismemberments that happen within the battles, as there were in Lord of the Rings, all that fun stuff.
But we
orcs and dwarves and elves
right.
and everything.
But Peter Jackson started as a horror director.
Yeah.
So we kind of have to remember that.
He knows his way around that stuff. He's doing it out of his own sensibility. So what he's gone and embroidered it with, you know, pieces of other writings that Tolkien did that have kind of been put now into The Hobbit and have expanded on the original book.
Because otherwise it probably couldn't make three movies,
I imagine. And not only three movies, but like this one is 169 minutes, which if I'm doing the math, is almost 3 hours.
Now, I did read, I'm not sure where, an interview with the screenwriters who are Peter Jackson's wife and their longtime collaborator.
Yeah.
And one thing that really struck me in that, and I have not read The Hobbit for 14 years, so I didn't remember that there were no women in The Hobbit or no female if women is the right word for dwarves.
Whatever they are.
And yes. So these two female screenwriters decided they had to add some women to the mix. And so I think it's Galadriel, the Kate
Blanchett
elf queen or whatever, yeah. Fairy queen.
She's some ethereal figure, yes.
I think she's an elf.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
She's up there with the elves in their compound, yeah.
From the trailer, and maybe we should give a listen to this so we can have a sense of it. We have a little clip. Here is the part of the trailer for The Hobbit.
Far to the east, over ranges and rivers, lies a single solitary peak. The dwarves are determined to reclaim their homeland.
I like visitors as much as the next hobbit. But I do like to know them before they come. Visiting.
Mr. Baggins?
At your service.
Hmm? I'm surrounded by dwarves. What are they doing here?
Oh, they're quite a merry gathering.
So, this is the Hobbit.
You asked me to find the 14th member of this company, and I have chosen Mr. Baggins.
Me? No.
Hobbits can pass unseen by most if they choose, which gives us a distinct advantage.
We will seize this chance to take back Erebor!
Here, Mr. Bilbo, where are you off to?
I'm going on an adventure!
So you might notice that that's a different Bilbo Baggins than the elder Bilbo,
yes.
Who was in The Lord of the Rings. I guess you had to pick a younger actor.
Yeah. The action takes place some decades before The Lord of the Rings.
I think like 70 or something like that.
I can see, yes, your expertise in this.
I've seen The Lord of the Rings many times,
yes, I must say.
So
Ian Holm, who played Bilbo, is in this movie at the beginning to recollect his previous adventure. The character is played by Martin Freeman.
And this has been my casting quandary for a while. You thought he was good, right?
Yes, I do. I think he's good, and I like him in general, too.
And I was just distraught when I saw the trailer, because Martin Freeman, for those of you who like the series Sherlock from the BBC on PBS with Martin Freeman as Watson, all I could think of is A, you're Watson, and B, so this is why the return of Sherlock has been delayed. Middle Earth, curse you.
Well, also, he's very memorable from the original incarnation of The Office.
Yes.
Aside Ricky
and
Gervais.
And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
well. He's got one of the best deadpan takes, reaction shots of anybody in the business right now.
Maybe that's good for a hobbit.
Which he employs fairly well in this world because everybody's crazy and all that. But I want to know why, because I know that you are a big fan of The Lord of the Rings, of Jackson's trilogy. Mm. So why are you not kind of anticipating this with the kind of fervor that I think a lot of fans are?
Yes, including my teenage son who has announced he's already going. I think because why not leave well enough alone?
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of sequels, and this feels like a sequel to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that I mean, Christmas Day, I will be watching The Lord of the Rings starting in the middle of the morning. It's that kind of movie. Is Eowyn in this movie? Arwen? Are there women bearing swords? No, it's a bunch of dwarves.
It's there are a number of things that are kind of challenging about the first section, the first installment. And one of them is the lack of female characters. It's quite striking. Apparently a couple of significant characters are coming along in parts 2 and 3, but they don't appear in this first installment, which is called an unexpected Journey. But also there's so much stage setting that needs to be done in the first part of this thing. So you get flashbacks to the backstory of this kind of war that was going on between dwarves and other creatures, and it takes up a lot of space. And there's also the sense that Peter Jackson knows that this audience is out there waiting for this, and a lot of The Hobbit feels kind of indulgent toward that. I know I don't have to rush through this scene because you guys are going to love hearing the dwarves sing this song that's going to go on for a couple of minutes.
I should now shout out, listeners, are you anticipating with more glee than me the arrival of The Hobbit, which I'm sure I'll see. If you are, we'd love to hear from you. And if not, we'd like to know why not. 206-543-5555. 5869, 206-543-KUOW, 1-800-289-5869. Or you can email us if I can get this computer to work correctly and open the email, 206-543-5869, or weekday at KUOW.org. It's not that I'm not planning to go. I will most likely go, but I have to say it's that the story of The Hobbit, while lovely, I read it to my son, mm-hmm. is not as compelling. The Lord of the Rings epic is epic. Mm-hmm. It's an epic. The Hobbit was not an epic.
Yeah. Well, it certainly has a much more of a whimsical quality to it. Although one of the highlights of this film is a moment where you do feel kind of the shiver of that big epic that's going to come. And that is when Bilbo meets
Gollum.
Very unusual character by the name of Gollum, yes, who's in a cave somewhere. And they have this great scene. Actually, it's the best scene in this film. Between them, it goes on for about 15 or 20 minutes or so, and it's a face-off, and it's their first meeting, and there's this ring that falls to the ground at one point in that scene. And
well, that actually showed up in Lord of the Rings, because it's a riddles. I'm assuming the riddles show up. I have to say I'm conversant in Middle Earth, and
yes.
I look forward to it. But I look forward to it because there's no vampires. I have to say I'm not a vampire fan. I know you've written about vampires, and
occasionally
it's just not my call. Robert, put your headphones on because we've got listeners. And Guy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
You wanted to...
I'm just calling to let everybody know that there's a little neighborhood theater in Columbia City called Arc Lodge Cinemas that's reopening for the first time after being closed for 2 years, and it's opening with The Hobbit, and we're all really excited about it.
Yes, and it's the former Columbia City Cinema purchased by Dave McRae and his family.
Exactly.
Going to have three screens, I understand, only one of which will have The Hobbit.
It does have three screens. Two of them on the main floor will have The Hobbit because we're still finishing putting sprinklers and fire alarm in there, and the city's been very kind to give us temporary use of the main floor.
Well, thank you for letting folks in Southeast Seattle know that you can go to your neighborhood theater, and thanks so much. It's now called the Arc Lodge Cinema. That's the old Columbia City Cinema, and it's always good to hear about a movie theater opening.
Good luck.
Rather than closing. Ian and Burien, you're not looking forward too much to the Hobbit?
I am not. The Hobbit is a story of Sheen. It's got a meandering kind of pace, and it sets this rich history in this beautiful world, and it's mellow, and it's enjoyable. And I don't think you can capture that kind of pace in a movie, especially Peter Jackson, who directed action-packed movies like King Kong and Lord of the Rings and things like that.
Are you not going to even bother to go, Ian?
Well, of course I'm going to see it.
But... I mean, come on, yeah.
But you're not really, you're in my camp. You're not quite looking forward to it, but you must not miss it, right?
I'm dubious is all. I just can't imagine how this is going to be like the book. But, you know, maybe that's good. Maybe it'll make a better movie than a book. I doubt it.
Well, I know that, Peter Jackson has put a lot of action sequences into this movie. And it's been a while since I read The Hobbit as well. But he's definitely beefed it up with some big, big scenes, chases and escapes and battles.
Thanks for that call, Ian. Let's see. Nancy, a Lilywop Hobbit, says she is eagerly awaiting another great Hobbit adventure. And let's see. Clay in Lakewood, what do you think?
You know, I think that Peter Jackson hasn't made a bad movie. I mean, I look at his history. All the movies are action-packed, sure. This is going to be another example of him turning an excellent novel into a phenomenal film. I mean, has he ever made a bad movie, one that wasn't rich with texture and utterly unbelievable?
You want to weigh in on that, Robert?
Did you see The Lovely Bones?
You know, I didn't. Did not see that.
Yeah, it's a bad movie. But he's a good director. He's a very talented man. And for all those reasons, The Lord of the Rings is really something special as a movie trilogy.
Yeah, thanks for that. Sarah in Greenwood emails to ask you to talk about the frame rate
yes.
in The Hobbit. Can you explain what a frame rate
we
is?
We should talk about that because you, depending on where you are, you will see a different Hobbit. There's a variety of different ways to see it, not just a couple. But what she's referring to is that although it's not quite right to say, well, most movies are shot in 24 frames per second. This is a standard rate.
That's the frame rate.
Yeah, okay. Back when people shot movies on film, which they don't anymore, of course. Peter Jackson and his crew and his scientists have devised a way to double that frame rate. So it would be the equivalent of 48 frames per second, bringing a great deal of crystal clarity and kind of a silkiness of movement and so on. And this is being really ballyhooed in the theaters in which it's going to open, which I'm not quite sure how many around the country, but at least 100 or so, including the Cinerama, which is where I saw it at a preview. And Jackson is very proud of it. He believes that it's going to make you feel as though you're part of the action. It's very realistic and so on. What I think a lot of people will think of is it looks like a soap opera. It looks like one of those BBC productions where they've shot the thing on video, and why does it look like that? And it struck me as a really amazing technological way of making something look cheaper.
Oh,
than
gosh.
It would look if it were a film, and it is freaky.
Okay, so you're saying I shouldn't go to the Cinerama to see this movie.
I'm saying that is what the experience is going to be very different from anything you have ever seen on a movie screen before. And if you are curious about that, you might see it, but I'm not sure. I think I might have preferred to have seen it on, except for the sort of curiosity about technological advances, I might have preferred to see it as a looking like a movie.
I have that option though, right?
You do, yes. There will be theaters where it is. You're going to have to read the ads really closely, actually, because
normal frame rate.
Yeah,
go here.
Say normal. though normal is, I mean, you could also see it in IMAX, where it apparently is going to look slightly different from either of those other formats.
Back to your thoughts about The Hobbit.
Movie.
Back to the movie itself. Walter from Ferndale says, I did a year of Old Norse when I was in college and first read The Lord of the Rings in 1967. I'm a big Tolkien fan because of his academic brilliance as well as his grasp of human nature. Jackson cannot really do him justice. I appreciate anything that he attempts. Thanks for that email. Walter, we go up to Seattle's Capitol Hill. Kim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling because I'm definitely looking forward to watching the movie, mainly because The Hobbit was the first major fantasy literature that I read one summer when I was 11 years old, and I think it's probably more of a nostalgic thing. I want to see how he's going to bring that book alive on film. So basically that's the reason why I want to watch the film.
And I think probably, Kim, a lot of folks are with you. Thank you for that call. Curiosity, and maybe you read the book as a kid and it just stuck with
you.
Yeah,
it is definitely a book that hits a lot of people at a certain age. You know, you come across it, and that's a very valid reason for, you know, being curious about what they're going to do with it.
Well, that's opening, and of course, much, much more in the next couple of weeks as we edge our way towards Christmas, because
yes,
this is
getting there.
'Tis the season. If you want to think about something totally different, tomorrow, the 13th of December, you have your annual film critic round table.
Yes.
Blowout's not the right word, is it?
All those things. festival, celebration.
It's at the Fry Museum.
Yeah, it's the 8th annual Critics Wrap at the Fry Art Museum, and it'll be in the evening at 7. It's free. And it's a panel of critics who will talk about 2012 in film. And it's always been fun, and we always bring up, we talk about our favorite movies, and it leads to discussions and arguments, I'm going to be moderating it, and we'll have critics Jim Emerson, Kathleen Murphy, and Andrew Wright mixing it up, and the audience is encouraged to mix it up, and it usually goes really well. So we'll kind of take a look back at the year.
And that's tomorrow night, and then something upcoming at the Northwest Film Forum.
On Friday afternoon at 5, get off work and come over and join us, because we will have another installment of another panel discussion, this one called Framing Pictures. And we're going to be talking there about things that we've been grateful for in 2012 in movies, movie-related. Could even be a DVD that came out that you liked, or some particular experience you had with an old movie, or a new movie. So we hope people will come and kind of share their ideas on that as well.
I wish I could keep all my ears straight and I could think of something I was grateful for.
Even if you can't.
Come anyway, 5 o'clock Friday, Northwest Film Forum. Robert Horton writes about the movies for the Everett Herald. You can read his blog, The Crop Duster. And as you heard, he's at the Fry Art Museum every month. Tomorrow happens to be the day. And he's a regular Wednesday guest here on Weekday. Always great to see you.
Thanks, Marcy.
We'll get the latest business news from around the Northwest coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Cupcake Royale, featuring cupcakes for holiday celebrations with decorations and the flavors of the season, including peppermint bark, eggnog, and boozy rum ball. Pre-ordering and information at cupcakeroyale.com. Natural, fresh, and local.
Clouds and rain, 44 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting rain the rest of this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, the high in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight, some fog overnight, the low in the upper 30s.
It's almost impossible to imagine Christmas at this point without Vince Guaraldi.
He just said, I got to play it for you before I forget it. And the song was called Linus and Lucy.
The Peanuts Christmas Masterpiece, next time in Studio 360. From PRI and WNYC.
And that comes your way Sunday night at 7 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. It's 1041.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, presenting the holiday comedy Inspecting Carol, a behind-the-scenes spoof of a theater's annual production of A Christmas Carol, playing November 23rd through December 23rd. Tickets at seattlerep.org.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. Maybe The Hobbit isn't your thing. Maybe you're more interested in business and economic development here in the Northwest. And if that's the case, you've probably been pretty busy trying to track the comings and goings of some of our most iconic companies. Starbucks, Amazon, Costco, Microsoft, they've all been making headlines, some of them good, some of them not so much. Michael Parks makes it his business to keep tabs on the Northwest economy. He's editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter. And nice to see you in the studios, Michael.
Good to be here.
Well, let's just start with Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, cover of Forbes. Why? What's up?
Cover of Fortune. He was on Fortune as its business person of the year.
Wow.
And he also ended up indirectly on the cover of The Economist. And that said something about one of our iconic local companies. On the cover of The Economist, an issue back, were four giants, the four giants of the internet that are waging war for the mind share and the attention of the globe's consumers. And they were Amazon, Google, Facebook, and I had it right, and of course, Apple. Which, and notice Microsoft was on the list. Amazon was. It says something about how far Microsoft has fallen behind.
So he was the business person of the year, Jeff Bezos. Right now, I guess he'd say he's the hiring agent of the year in the Northwest.
Absolutely.
Huge growth.
Yeah. Headcount at Amazon, they disclose it only once a quarter in their SEC filing. They don't return reporters' phone calls or answer their email. They won't tell us how many people work for Amazon in Seattle. They have 11 buildings in South Lake Union, no signs on any of the buildings. But in the SEC filing for the quarter ended September 30th, 81,000 plus employees. 18% headcount growth in 90 days, 58% headcount growth in a year's time, up 58% in a year. And this does not count temps, and it does not count contract employees. And, Marcy, if you look at their website and are looking for a job at Amazon.com, you will find listings for something like 2,500 jobs in Seattle. In Seattle, not other places, and relatively well-paid jobs.
Now, I have to say that that's 11 buildings built. There are other buildings under construction, bigger buildings.
They have three downtown office towers, each 1.1 million square feet. If you add up all the figures, it's about 6 million square feet of office space, either in the planning, leased, or controlled.
So does that make Amazon a bigger employer than Boeing at this point?
No. We have in the aerospace industry in Washington State, they're not all at Boeing, but we're approaching 100,000. And we're approaching 100,000. We will probably go over 100,000 in the first half of next year. That will be the first time that's happened since, I think, May of 1999. But among private companies, Amazon would rank certainly in the top five for employment in the Seattle area, maybe in the top two or three.
And the University of Washington, one of the big employers as well. But so Boeing is, Amazon's growing.
Sure.
Boeing adding jobs because there's still a backlog of planes to build, right?
They have. I looked at the figures the other day on their backlog, and it almost took my breath away. Backlog, undelivered orders for the 737, the most popular airplane ever built, over 3,000. And as fast as they're delivering them this year, I think they're building 32, 33 planes a month. The backlog is growing. They've had some cancellations for the very fuel-efficient new airplane, the 787, but they still have a backlog of over 800. They're struggling to get the production rate going. They still have something like 300-plus orders for the big twin, the 777, that competes with the double-decker A380. So at the current production rate, now this duration will change, but at the current production rate, it would take Boeing 7 years to deliver all the airplanes they have in the backlog.
So that's Amazon and Boeing both doing hiring here in the area. Starbucks recently announced an expansion, but not here.
Well, it's a combination. They had an investor day in New York City last week. Two kind of headlines came out of that. One was that China will be Starbucks's second largest market in 2014. So it's a measure of how fast they're growing in what, let's face it, is the second largest economy in the world in terms of its output. But they also made headlines by saying they will add 1,500 outlets in the United States over the past three or four years. And we already think there's a Starbucks in every block.
Well, there must be places where there are no Starbucks, or are they just talking about going back to the markets where they've done well?
I think what you will see is broadening the footprint, taking the Starbucks brand more into rural and less served areas. And one point about the expansion in the U.S. is that a lot of these will be stores within stores. For example, a Starbucks in a supermarket or a Starbucks in another retail establishment, as opposed to freestanding, where they really have achieved a pretty good penetration, certainly in the big cities and suburban malls.
That's all happy, happy news.
Yep.
In Britain, Starbucks is not quite as cheery as it is here and in China.
Starbucks was criticized and has been identified in the UK as one of those companies that pays no corporate income tax. It so arranges its affairs that it does not owe any income tax to the UK. Last week, it decided after public criticism that it would voluntarily pay a share of its sales. Marcy, this is, it's part of a game. I call it tax arbitrage. All companies do it. And I have actually a rather simple and elegant solution to the problem of tax arbitrage. Let's make all companies pay out all of their earnings to their shareholders. Abolish the corporate income tax. No more corporations complaining that the U.S. income tax is too high. Pay all of the earnings out to shareholders. Let the shareholders pay at their rate, and make the penalty for cheating on the rules for not paying out all of your earnings, make it draconian, a death penalty or something akin to that.
I can see that. That's going to be picked right up, Michael.
Yeah.
It's right there. I'm moving on to the second most famous big box retailer in the United States, our own Costco, who has decided to give shareholders a special early Christmas present,
Absolutely.
A dividend per share, $7 per share?
$7 a share. The interesting thing about Costco, there are two interesting things about this story. One, they're borrowing the money.
Yeah, so that was interesting.
You know, go figure.
A lot of money.
But that's also because interest rates are so low in the United States. Let's face it, we're entering the fifth year with interest rates essentially being held at 0%. And so corporations of all kinds are borrowing in the U.S. I heard a phrase last week that I hadn't heard for some time. It is that the United States is the new carry trade. And the carry trade refers to the idea of borrowing in a currency that has a low interest rate and then putting the money into a currency that has a high interest rate. It used to be done in Japan and still done in Japan. But it says something about our economy that we have become a carry trade.
They're also giving out this dividend, even though they've borrowed the money to do it. It has something to do with uncertainty about tax rates after the first of the year.
Yeah. One way or the other, the tax rate on dividends is going to go up after the first year. And actually, many, many companies have accelerated their dividend payments or declared special dividends. Costco drew some criticism from the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, which is about as far to the right as you can get, partly because Costco executives in general favored the Obama administration's kind of battle to get millionaires and billionaires pay higher taxes.
Well, let's move on to the one company that you mentioned briefly as MIA when we're talking about four big tech companies, and that's our friends across the lake, Microsoft. I saw a bar graph in the Seattle Times, I believe. It was either the New York Times or the Seattle Times, that was tracking Microsoft's new tablet, which is barely registering.
The Surface.
Yeah, Surface. I can't not even remember the name of it. I want to call it the Source. Right. Very, very poor sales.
Right.
I think it's not available in a lot of places. And it made me wonder about, you know, Windows 8. And
Sure. It
unveiled to great hoopla.
Yeah.
Has it done well so far?
I have not read anything that suggests that it is being taken up. The key for Windows 8, and really 2013 is going to be a big year for Microsoft. It needs a big take-up of the new operating system by the Fortune 500. I think Microsoft announced that it had licensed 40 million copies of Windows 8, but it didn't distinguish between consumer and what's called OEM. In other words, all the hardware manufacturers that are building laptops and computers put the newest operating system on it. So it could be that there have been 40 million licenses issued, and most of them are sitting in a storeroom or a warehouse someplace. It's undelivered inventory. So a big year for Microsoft. It needs a big take-up of Windows 8, and it needs the Surface and the phones. So it's been behind both in tablets and also in phones. It needs both of those to get some momentum, and we don't see it yet.
When will we get an official release of earnings from them?
Well, Microsoft has just begun a new fiscal year, so we'll get something on the first quarter of fiscal 2013 in late January. I wouldn't expect that to be a key one. I would expect the one that comes in April, which will be the fiscal first half for Microsoft. We'll know whether Windows 8 and the Surface are going good.
Well, Michael Parks, thanks again for coming in today, talking about some of the Northwest iconic businesses, their ups, most ups. One down. Michael Parks is editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter, a regular guest on our program.
Thank you, Marcy.
And turning from earnings to thinking about what you do with extra money you might have, all this month, Weekday is talking about organizations that could use your help. Today, Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Puget Sound joining us, Pamela Shields, the Vice President of Communications and Community Engagement. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Could you briefly, for folks who've never heard of Big Brothers and Big Sisters, talk about your mission?
Absolutely. We are a youth mentoring organization. We match children and adults in the community in a one-to-one relationship and sort of let them go off and do their magic together and check in with them regularly to make sure that everything is going well and that there's safety in the match and just to make sure that we're seeing positive results there.
So at this time of year, there are a lot of nonprofit organizations that have special toy collection drives or fundraising drives. Anything particular that you are looking for in terms of help during the holidays?
Well, you know, we don't do anything quite like that. We try to stay really on our mission. And so really at this time of year, what we're looking for are our volunteers to become big brothers and big sisters. We've always got a need for bigs, as we call them. We've always especially got a need for men to be big brothers. We've got hundreds of boys waiting all the time on our wait list, and specifically even more than that, men of color to step up and be big. So that's our sort of big call to action. There are a couple other things for us at this time of year and any time during the year, actually. Cash donations, any sort of in-kind giving, that's always very helpful. And then a lot of people, I think, don't know, but we have a donation center, which we collect clothing, used clothing and household items, which we then turn and sell to Value Village, and that helps run our program as well. And there are big purple bins out all over the community where people can donate.
I just have to ask a logistical question about volunteering to be a big brother or big sister. What kind of time commitment are we talking about?
We ask for a minimum of a one-year commitment, and we generally ask bigs and littles to get together 3 to 4 times a month. And sort of depending on what that looks like for somebody, it might be a couple hours at a time, it might be a whole day. It really is dependent on schedules of the bigs and littles. We also have a school-based program that is one day a week for an hour, and that takes place on school grounds. So there are a couple of different ways that you can volunteer as a big.
So what's the first step to becoming a big?
A big, yeah.
Yeah, what's the first step?
Is filling out an inquiry form, and you can do that online on our website, which is BBBSPS, as in Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Puget Sound, .org. And basically that gets the process started, and then it takes you the rest of the process is filling out an application, doing a pre-match training, we call it, an interview, reference checks, background checks, all that stuff, to make sure that everybody's, you know, that this is a safe thing for these kids.
I was just going to ask if you do a reference check, because
absolutely,
if somebody's...
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Background checks and drive checks, and then reference checks as well.
How long is the list of boys in particular waiting to be matched with somebody?
I think right now our wait list sort of stands around 500. That'll go sort of up and down depending. And the majority, I'd say a good 85% of those are boys.
Wow. Well, as you heard, Pamela Shields says, if you'd like to volunteer, this is something that you can do right now. Contact Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Puget Sound. Pamela Shields, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pamela Shields is Vice President of Communications and Community Engagement for Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Puget Sound. The organization assists kids who face challenges by pairing them up with one-to-one mentors outside their family to help support them in whatever they might be going through. We have more details about all the organizations that we've been profiling this month at our website, kuow.org. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Alexandra Garrettin and Danielle Anthony Goodwin are our interns. Andy Hurst engineers our program. Hope you join us tomorrow. We're going to talk about a big coal scoping hearing coming up at the Convention Center in Seattle. Also, Douglas Smith on the fall of the Russian aristocracy and radio retrospective, plus a look at some holiday cookbooks all coming your way tomorrow on Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, it's 10:59. We'll get an update from NPR News in less than 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Black Nativity this December 6th through the 23rd at the Moore Theater. Black Nativity features the poetry of Langston Hughes, the Nativity Band, and guest star B.B. Winans December 21st through the 23rd. Tickets at stgpresents.org.
On the next Fresh Air, David Nassau talks about his biography of Joseph Kennedy, the patriarch. Even after his sons, Jack and Bobby, were president and attorney general, they still turned to their influential father. During the Bay of Pigs crisis, the brothers were in the Oval Office.
And Bobby says to Jack, "Let's call Dad. He'll make us feel better."
Join us.
That comes your way tonight at 8 on our second program service, KUOW2. You can learn more and view the complete program schedule at KUOW2, that's the number 2, .org.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at TIAACREF.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.